From the center of the universe, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, this is the SDM Show with your host, Rob Cairns. The SDM Show focuses on business, life, productivity, digital marketing, WordPress, and more. Sit back, relax, grab your favorite drink, and enjoy the show. Here is Rob.
I'm Rob Cairns. I'm the founder, CEO, and chief creator of Amazing Ideas at Stunning Digital Marketing. In this podcast, I have Tim Nash with me to discuss his take on WordPress security. Sit back, relax, enjoy the show. This podcast is sponsored by Stunning Digital Marketing, the agency that can help protect your WordPress website today. Go to stunningdigitalmarketing.com and see what we can do to help you protect your business investment. That's stunningdigitalmarketing.com. Hey, everybody. Good morning. It's Rob Cairns here. And today I'm here with security expert Tim Nash. How are you today, Tim?
I'm doing okay. Thank you very much. I was enjoying the lights going up on the slides just then. I was like, oh, it's snowing. And then it's like, oh, no, it's snowing back upwards. That's not right.
You're funny. You know, it's funny. We were talking before the show. You and I, at the time of this record, were just on WP Builds together. And interesting enough, we were on with Jess Frick and Taco Verda, who I absolutely adore. And of course, our esteemed host, Nathan Wrigley. And out of that show, everybody that was on that particular episode has now been on this podcast. So welcome.
Thank you. I would say you'd say the best till last, but that's not true at all.
Well, you know what? I say the same thing. I think we don't give ourselves enough credit sometimes, right, Tim? So that's just the way it is. So I want to jump in and ask you before we dive into security. How did you find yourself in the WordPress world? Do you have a bit of a WordPress origin story?
I mean, it's a sort of very similar tale to a lot of people, I guess. But I started in WordPress very long time ago, like pre-plugins long time ago.
Yeah.
And I was actually working for a university at the time, and I wanted to build a membership site for a side project. And there wasn't a membership site capabilities or anything like that. All the things you think of today weren't there. And so I found something that half did the job in typical open source fashion, and went at it and hacked at it for a bit until I could get it to do what I wanted it to do. Brought in a friend who helped get it over the line. And then from there, we realized, oh, that was cool. And went on to do other projects. And then over time, I found that other people needed to have a membership site. And so I helped set up one of the very first UK-based, certainly, dev agencies who built commercial plugins. And we can sort of work our way through the timeline of where we were at that point in the WordPress evolution. We went to one of the very first WordCamps in the UK. We sponsored it, and we were booed at it because we were commercial WordPress developers.
Are you kidding me?
No. Wow. So there's an entire room of people who are there on our dime and got the opportunity to boo us when it was announced what we did. So that was fun. Obviously, the world's moved on quite a bit since then, as have I. But that's where I started. Being booed in a big auditorium in Manchester University, being booed.
You know, it's funny. They always say, any publicity is better than no publicity. So I guess people recognize what you guys were doing. Like, I don't know what to say about that, right? Yeah. And I've had this discussion with many people. Like, there's still that cross in the open source community about making money off a free project, right? We always end up in that crossroads. And I know a number of plugin developers, Mark Westgard over at WS Forms, how he keeps showing up at podcasts, I'll never know, but that's another story. He's a good friend. Adrian Toby at Groundhog, if you know Adrian, Adrian's a good friend. His dad was one of my mentors in the marketing game and people like that. And we're always talking about how do you draw that line, right?
It's a hard one, and it's got easier by the fact that there's now a market, and that it's considered more the norm now. But yes, back then it was a very strange scenario to be in, and I honestly thought at the time that we were not necessarily pioneers, but we were going to be pushing the direction that we'd find things like WordPress.org being much more open to us, Things didn't. Some things changed for the better, and some things changed for the worst. And it's now interesting looking back and sitting there going, well, we were doing really well at certain things way before they became a sort of mission critical part of WordPress. A really good example is we actually had an updating system in place and auto updates in place in sort of 2009, 2010. For our premium plugin, because that's we were right. Like, well, you know, we you're spending money on us and we're empowering your site to take money. You should probably keep this thing up to date. So it's interesting how that things like that, which the rest of the community has only just started to catch up. I mean, the idea of automatic updates is only really still something that terrifies 95% of people.
Or even managed WordPress hosting, because in a managed environment, they often control your updates. And that terrifies people too. I mean, they say, why am I not running the latest version of Core? Because a lot of managed WordPress hosts stay a version before. I mean, that's just the way they roll, right?
I mean, it does depend on host. Quite a lot of the hosts have now realized that to that their detriment, that perhaps not keeping up to date and at least not patching their WordPress versions will result in not just one, but thousands of sites being compromised. So on the whole, the hosts are pretty good at staying at least their core up. But every host has its own way of managing updates. You've got people like Dopey Engine who have their like smart plugin manager tool. And then you've got other hosts that just like effectively run Dopey CLI in the background and just go, yeah, Dopey plugins update --all and job done. And they could, and there's a lot of disparity between individual hosts. And then there's all these other tools that you can use if you're not on a managed host. It's still quite a wild west. We haven't standardized yet. Give it another 20 years.
Maybe. So you're in the security field. So am I, to some degree. One of the things I do is I lock down websites. I now manage, from a security perspective, over 400. So I know tools better than most people. How did you end up in that field, in that expertise?
So in a previous life, I used to do pen testing and before WordPress. And then as I sort of left the development field, I got more and more involved in system administration. I worked for a hosting company as their platform lead, which basically means that I did a bunch of stuff. And I went from, I look after 3 or 4 sites to, I appear to now be looking after 40,000 WordPress websites.
So wonderful, isn't it?
I should probably try and keep these up to date and secure somehow. Obviously, there was a team. It wasn't just me. That would be a terrifying thought. But so I really got my passion back for security during that phase. And to be honest, the easiest thing for me was to sit there and go, right, well, what can I do? Well, we can implement all this stuff. What can I do? I can teach people, because at the time, the company I worked for was very keen on an education program and was very keen on being seen to be delivering an education program, which is ideal for me, because I basically came along and said, what I'd like to do is go to WordCamps and user groups, and I want to talk about security. And they went, what we'd like you to do is go to WordCamps and user groups and talk about security. So that meshed up nicely.
Awesome.
And I was able to sort of follow that passion through. When I left them, I was like, well, actually, I could, you know, I'd like to take the things that I know now, put on a wide scale, and bring them back down to individual sites. Because one of the things that I really disliked about working at a hosting company is I never got to stay on the project more than 30 seconds. I was the person who you called when you call, when the other person didn't know the answer and the other person didn't know the answer and the other person. So I was at the end of the chain. And what I would often be looking at is 4 lines of your project. I would never see a bigger picture. I'd never see other parts of it. So when I left the hosting, I was like, well, I'd like to get involved in people's projects. So I thought, what better way to do that than become a security consultant and terrify everybody for a living?
That's so cool. I ended up in this space. It's interesting. I worked in healthcare for 21 years. I was the team leader for the client services call center, i.e. where everybody went to when they had a problem. And I fell in love with security on an enterprise perspective, a server perspective. And our security lead used to come sit in my office every week. We'd have these chats. What's the help desk seeing? What are you guys seeing? How can I help you? How can you help me? And I just started diving in more. And then I ran across a legendary hacker by the name of Kevin Mitnick. And we all know who he is. He just passed away recently. And he was kind of big on the whole social re-engineering side. He's written a number of books, The Art of Deception, The Art of Intrusion. And he talks about how people social reengineering. So I got fascinated with that side of it. And then that's how I ended up in it. I just kind of grew from there. Interesting. Different paths, but same result, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we talk in WordPress security. In your opinion, what's the number one thing site owners do wrong? I have to ask.
We've already passed it. They don't update their sites. Mm-hmm. Inevitably, sites not up to date is the number one reason that sites get hacked. It's as simple as that. There's no point for a bad actor to try and come up with some cunning way to break into your site. They don't have a grudge against you normally. If they do, then that's a separate issue, and we can talk about that in a bit. But for the vast, vast majority of people, it's an automated attack, and no one's going to craft an automated attack against you specifically. They craft them against the vulnerabilities that are known. The vulnerabilities are known, tend to be the older, out-of-date plugins. Very rare you see a zero-day vulnerability in a WordPress plugin that is then being actively exploited. Particularly quickly. It's nearly always there's some sort of patching, not every single time, but more often than not, if you got hacked, the chances are you got hacked for a vulnerable plugin. That vulnerable plugin probably had an update and you probably didn't install it. And it's as simple as that. And that counts for something like 99.99% of cases. So it's not like a small figure and us finding other things to do. So if we can fix people updating their websites, we don't have a job. We can go and sit on the beach.
And I hate to tell you, I don't think that's ever going to happen. I know, and I'm sure you're in the same boat. By the time you look at a site or I look at a site, and the first thing I look at is plugins that are out of date, core that's out of date. And it's like, here we go. And it's the same. And then they look at you like, I don't have time to do this. And it's like, so then why aren't you paying somebody to do it? So that's problem number one. Does 2FA, two-factor authentication, slow hackers now?
So if we've got all, if we put our update users in, update plugins in one basket, the next lot of problems is users.
Yep.
That's, hey, I reused the same password across everything. Oh, and by the way, the password was my beautiful daughter wand, or whatever they choose to use. A multi-factor authentication has its place. It doesn't always prevent people from getting through. If someone has managed to socially engineer you to the point that you are actively giving that person username and password information on a one-to-one basis, then the next step for them is to ask you for the two-factor authentication.
Of course.
Now, there are some tooling that prevents that, but to give you a really good example, I watched an experiment where someone was on the phone and they were told, oh, yep, so I'm just going to log in for you. What's your username? What's your password? Oh, you're going to get a code through to your phone. What's that?
Could you give it to me?
Yep. Yeah. And they just, yeah, carry on. That sort of attack will always defeat MFA. Now, there are some really impressive phishing attacks which use a fake login screen. And how it works is that you put in your username and password, and in real time, normally with a phishing attack, they don't in real time check the credentials. Yep. They'll just throw you to a screen that says, oh, it's dead. Sorry, something's wrong. Or nothing, depending on what they want to do. Or just install malware or whatever they've got to do on you. But they don't normally then check the credentials in real time. The bad actor will come along, grab the credentials and make use of it later. Or probably not ever check it and actually just shove it on a list and sell it. But there are some attacks where they will ask for your username and password, and the first thing they'll do is make a post request to your website with the username and password. Yeah. They'll then look for the feedback, and if the feedback comes and says, hey, I've got 2FA, now they should know with reasonable certainty whether or not MFA is installed.
Yeah.
Because there's enough ways to iterate through tooling. There's enough little telltale signs that you can normally see. One of the tips I would give if you're ever setting up a multi-factor authentication is don't go for any of the plugins which put the MFA field underneath your username and password field, showing it at the front. Because that's a pretty big obvious, hey, we're going to need that key field as well. You want it to be a second step on the next page, because that just adds to making it harder for an attacker to know it's there. But that's attackers probably can get that information in various ways. So, yeah, MFA works. It works for a lot of people. It's no defense against just having cruddy passwords, though.
And then I know when we were on builds together, you and I both commented on an article where the WordPress.org team, and I use that word in quotes, sent out a notification saying, go download this plugin. And what a brilliant phishing attack, to be honest with you. And it was funny because I had said at the time, I had had several clients call me. I had one client that actually downloaded the plugin. Sweet, wonderful guy. Yeah, he did. And it was like, thank you very much to Backdoors. Like, we need to stop doing this stuff. Like, if you're an inside owner and you're not sure, ask somebody. Just don't do it.
It's hard, though, because that particular email was, it still had telltale signs that yourself or most people, if they stopped and thought about it for a while, would pick up on. But it was still crafted enough, and it had that the key component with all good scams, which is a sense of urgency. If you're ever finding yourself being like, why am I being pressured to do this thing right now? When it came out of nowhere, sometimes disasters happen and think you do need to do things, but normally when you're being pressured into a certain route to do something straight away, right now, this very second, you must do this. That's a big red flag to hang on a minute. You're not giving me time. Why are you not giving me time to think about this? And whenever you're in that scenario, I mean, this is a good example for life. If you're ever in a scenario where you're feeling like you're being railroaded by something, it is always worth saying, stop. I'm going to take a minute. I'm just going to look this through and reread what I'm being asked to do. I'm not going to do the instructions you're just sending me down. And then you'd start picking up on the little things and go, this doesn't make sense. Why would they want a plugin? Can't they just update WordPress core? This doesn't make sense. And the alarms bells will start to ring properly. But that particular email worked by railroading you, and you were going to do this thing and you had to do it now because, oh boy, what would happen if you didn't do it? It would be catastrophic. And so you did it. And I don't feel bad. I think anybody who fell for it, they shouldn't feel bad. I think there is clearly a need for more education. We haven't got there yet, but it was really well written. And if they could just learn to spell, they'd have done so much. But I don't get it, though. How can you be so good at writing something like that and then get the name of the product wrong?
Oh, I know. That was a telltale sign in that one.
Yeah. I mean, it's come to the point that we're now using capital P as a security mechanism. It's like our way of identifying. It's the equivalent of quite a lot of banks here, certainly here in the UK, had a system where you had to pick an animal, and then they'd show you a picture on the login screen to show that it was that they knew. And in many ways, our equivalent in WordPress is just whether or not there's a capital P in the word WordPress.
So we've talked about 2FA. I want to jump into backups for a second, because the biggest concern I have with backups coming from an enterprise environment is, we used to do disaster recovery days. And the reason we did them was to make sure our backups were good. And I would bet you, and I just went through this with a client where they said, oh, we have backups. And then I looked at their backup archives and none of them were good. And I would bet 99% of the clients who don't use somebody like you or myself have never tested their backups. So they don't have a clue if these backups have been taken for 2 years work or don't work. Isn't that a problem?
I mean, it is. And I like to use the phrase, if you haven't tested your backup, you don't have a backup, you have a prayer. Now, it's quite difficult for some people to actually do that. I mean, quite a lot of these systems, they will download a backup plugin, for example. Something like Updraft. There are plenty of them. But they'll download the Backup Buddy. They'll download these plugins. they'll install it and it's configured and that's it. They just go. They never investigate what it does or how it does it. And you end up with wonderful scenarios where I came across regularly. Updraft Plus would back itself up.
Yes, actually.
So yeah. You'd get ever expanding backups with the backup inside the backup inside the backup. But then you can't restore that backup without having another site downloading it, moving the backup across, in putting it back on, go through. Once the person started this process, it's going to take them time to even understand how they're going to do it. Most people don't have a disaster recovery plan because their disaster recovery plan, if they had a backup program, was that. But they've not thought beyond that. They've never tested these things. If you're doing regular development on your site, one way you can do this sort of testing is that instead of when you're getting your dev environment and start, let's say you're starting a new project, you're about to go, I'm going to go and start my new theme. You start by taking the last backup that you did and restoring from that. Yeah. And in fact, if you want to keep your dev environment up to date with live by using your backups, that's one way.
That's how I do it. Actually, my dev for my agency site is an exact restore of my backup. So I subscribe to that theory wholeheartedly. Actually,
you're also going to find a lot more of the bugs and the little things that don't work for some reason because you're now actively using it. The second method is to, if you want to go the more enterprisey route, and the one that I fully subscribe to, but I understand why most clients can't implement it for various reasons, which is to, before you take a backup, because you've got tests, because everybody writes tests.
Yes.
But let's assume everybody's written some tests for whether they were doing development or they've just written tests because tests are good. You run your gamut of tests on your live site. You then take your backup, you then install your backup on your dummy sites and you run the gamut of tests again and you know that they're okay. Even better, we then can do the updates that we wanted to on the live site and rerun those tests again. So now we're testing our live, we've got these tests. We've got a test, we've got a backup, we've got the updates and we retest and we know all the way through everything is okay. That is the perfect world. This is, and you can do it on small sites and big sites. I do it for my personal site. I do it for client sites at, do use big WooCommerce sites, but it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort because you need that testing in place in the first place. And that in itself is effort. But it's worth doing because you use those tests all the time. I was talking to a client today and we were talking about how we were going to get them there. And we were saying, well, actually, maybe automatic updates is not on your roadmap for the next year or even 2 years because you have weird stuff. So we're not going to get there quickly. But what we can do is start when you do an update, okay, what do you test? As in, do you go to the homepage? Do you put a test transaction through? Write that down, right? Every single step down. So we've got a process. Excellent. Yep. We love processes. We love it when people write things out in nice, easy, step-by-step process. Because the next thing you do is go, well, you're not running that. Let's get a robot to do that for us.
Yep.
We'll turn that into some sort of acceptance integration test that a system can run. Now we've just halved update time, if not significantly reduced it even more. Because now you run your tests, do your updates, run your tests.
Yep.
No manual interaction on the testing phase. Once we're there, we can then start talking about automated tests. But I know we've switched from backups. Backups are really, really important. You should always take backups. You should always take your backups as well. If you're ever thinking, oh, but my host takes my backups, your host takes brilliant backups, but they're their backups. They're not your backups.
And they get hacked. There have been hosting companies. There was A2 Hosting in Europe, in UK, that got hacked. There was Melbourne IT in Australia that got hacked a number of years ago. And there was a company out of Montreal, W3 Hosting, where the hackers took out the backup server as well. So
Manage.com got ransomware, and all of their clients got ransomware, and the backups got ransomware. This is a lead on that you, but it's still, even in these non-extreme scenarios, the fact that they're not your backups, then you're not got the sovereignty of that data, means that you're reliant on them to do a restore when they go, we can only restore from last week, and we have to restore everything. We can't just restore, insert whatever you wanted. These are all very common. On the host getting hacked, in a similar way that you don't necessarily want to rely on your host's backups, it's worth starting to think, do I want to rely on my host's DNS? I mentioned manage.com just now. They got ransomware, and all of their systems went offline, including the control panel.
Yep.
So all these people who were going, my website, it's down. Okay, they're not coming back up anytime soon. I need to migrate, but I can't migrate because my DNS is with them.
Yep.
I wrote a blog post a couple of years ago called Your Host Has Ransomware. And in it, I have a little challenge, which is basically how long will it take you to be able to restore your site if you had access, if your host completely disappeared? Maybe we can link that into some show notes, because I think it's really a nice sort of prep tale for you to go through and go, oh, well, you might want to think about these things and how they're associated with your hosting, one of which is backups.
But I agree wholeheartedly with you. Now, I want to dive in a little more. Backups. I had a client yesterday ask me, how often should you do backups? And my response is, it depends. And I'm not trying to be vague. It depends what type of site. I've got an e-commerce client right now who's got 400 products, and they're making $10,000 US a day. That site gets backed up multiple times during the day because of the transactions. If it's a brochure site that's static and doesn't change, once a week might work. And then the question always becomes is, how long do you keep those backups for? I keep a minimum, and this is a bare minimum, of a weekly backup for a client for 6 months on an offline NAS server. I go that far back, because we all know you can have malware infected today and the payload is not invoked for 3 months. And I've seen cases where I've had to go back over 3 months. What do you think about that? Those two scenarios?
So the time between infection and exploitation is increasing.
Yep.
So the time between a vulnerability being made public and it being exploited is being reduced. Yep. So these two things are weirdly contractual. So that means that we're getting scenarios where people are getting hacked, but they don't know about it. And worse, they're getting hacked and then they're patching and don't know that the backdoor is there. And that backdoor stays dormant for a longer period of time than it historically has. A really good example of this is WooCommerce Payments, which was a payment gateway. They got hacked in March. The window of opportunity was really quite small. It was a couple of weeks exploitation.
Yeah.
We're still seeing people who were hacked then now finding out they were hacked back then, because they found the rogue admin user and the other two backdoors that were put in place.
I saw one 2 weeks ago, actually.
Yeah,
exactly that hack.
Yeah, so this is happening more and more. Now, the thing is, I would always argue there's really only a couple of times where you should ever restore from a backup when it comes to a hacked site. The vast majority of times, I don't recommend restoring from backups for hacked sites because you don't know when they were hacked. So we either have to go, all right, we're going to restore from a year ago and be sure. Or we have to go, okay, well, we can't just restore from backups. So we're going to have to effectively rebuild this site. Not completely. there's ways around to do this in a sensible way, but get there very quickly. There are a couple of times I would always say you restore from backup. One is ransomware. That's a really good example of where you would want to, you can restore from backup because you have to, you might want to burn the site again and then rebuild it afterwards, but you need something to put it up in the first place. And the second one is ironically phishing.
I agree.
Because we know when we were phished, we can work that out quite easily. So as long as we know when you opened the email and clicked it, we know when we restore the backup to. Out of those two scenarios, I wouldn't necessarily recommend restoring from a backup. So for me, I'm not as worried about having backups that last 6 months to a year, though I think that they're really useful for other things, because I have been in that meeting where someone's gone, so that feature, yeah, why is it broken? Well, what feature? That feature, the one that's here, is like that file hasn't existed for 6 months.
Yeah.
Oh. Can you get it back? No, our backups are only for 28 days. What I would do is suggest that there are some really good backup strategies where you basically take, you have the, if you're doing daily backups, you do so the next first, you have 2 weeks worth of daily backups, then you have one at the monthly mark, and then you have one at the 3 month mark, and then one at the 6 month mark. And these rotate through almost on a daily basis. So you're building out, and then that last one gets bumped and bumped and bumped. This means that you at least have some data there, but you don't need to keep everything. You could also consider whether or not a site is changing regularly. While I think daily backups at minimum, sometimes might need to be hourly. But for some sites, you might not have user interaction. It might be that brochureware site. You might even want to hook your backup into, I published a blog post, the site should be backed up. If that's the only time that there's any changes on the site, then that's probably the point you should do the backups. So it really does check, the frequency really does depend. If you're in doubt, opt for daily. But I think on a large e-commerce site, daily is not good enough. Also consider that you have different types of backups. You can be backing up the database versus backing up files.
Yeah.
And I tend to recommend you are backing up your database more often than you're backing up your files. Files can often be recreated. It's much harder to recreate the database. So if we did lose that, you know, if we did make, if a blog post had a pretty picture attached to it and we lose that pretty picture in the next 12 hours, that's okay. If we lose the customer's order, not so okay. Yeah. That's going to have a upset client who's going to not want to know why we've lost these orders.
I agree with you. The other thing, you know, we talk about this stuff is, if, and I just went through this too, I had a client who was a problem client, so I fired him 2 years ago. And what did this silly client do? His new web dev didn't change where the backups were going, and didn't change, oh, this gets better, and didn't change where the notifications were going. So I've been getting all his notifications for 2 years. To the point I finally went into my email about 6 months ago and set up a rule and said anything that comes. And I had emailed them multiple times and saying, if your web dev is nicely, any grain of salt, get them to fix this stuff because you're at risk. So what happens 2 weeks ago? His site goes down. He knows the backups are going to my server. He calls me up and says, could I have a backup? I said, no. And he said, what do you mean no? It's mine. I said, no. I fired you 2 years ago. What did your web dev do? The long and short of this is we came to some financial remuneration in the middle. But if you're going to move your site around, and this is just standard housekeeping, make sure your backups are going where you think they're going. Make sure your notifications are going where you think you're going. That's key, isn't it?
Yeah. I think... just having so many people just install a plugin and think they're done.
Yeah.
And also uninstalling Clean Up Your Stuff, the number of sites that I come along and go, oh, you have a backup folder full of backups. And yeah. that backup plugin hasn't been on there for a very long time. And it, apart from anything else, it's taking up file. You know, I managed to save a client hundreds of dollars a month because we went in and went, well, you don't use this backup plugin anymore. Like, yeah, no, we don't. We took it off years ago. Right, but the backups are still here because you weren't backing up to a third-party place. You were backing up to yourself.
Yep.
Ah, is that bad? Yeah. So, I mean, that's another thing we haven't mentioned, which is you should put your backup somewhere that is not your server.
Yeah, that's a bad idea.
Yep.
Because let's go back to all we keep using the scenario of ransomware, but let's go back to that one. Ah, it's a good one. Store from our backup on the thing that is currently ransomed. Excellent. We have no way to get to our backups.
That's a good plan.
Ideally, again, you want this like 3-2-1 scenario where you really, in the perfect world, would be backing up to a remote host somewhere and would have a localized copy in our within our own network, be that your house or be that the office scenario. We'd have it maybe going down to a NAS as well. But we'd be doing that. That might not be our primary source, but we'd want at least a copy every so often coming down here. For example, for me, my backups go to a remote cloud storage, but the one a month that I take, that's always the my monthly one, I also have a secondary copy of that locally here in the house.
That's good. Good idea.
And ultimately, that does mean that I can go onto that and go, I have a copy. I can use that. Yes, it's behind. But if we're at the stage where my site's gone, my cloud hosting support's gone, then we'll be happy for what we have. And if it's a month out of date, that's not a problem. We can rebuild. It's better than nothing.
Yeah, so true. The approach I go is I have a Synology NAS server, RAID 5, because I don't play it around. RAID drives do go. I also have a Synology NAS server offsite at a friend's place that I graciously pay their internet connection for every month because they give me the hydro to run this NAS server. So we came to an agreement. Those two NAS servers, Synology has a cool little thing that will let you keep your NAS servers in sync. So that helps. And then the one here is actually backed up to the cloud as well. You can do that off of Synology. So I've covered myself because I've got two servers, plus a cloud storage, I'm good. And I don't, what we have to get people to understand is having one copy and one in the cloud isn't good enough. You got to do more than that. And I don't care if it's your website, your files, or whatever you're dealing with, you got to take backup seriously.
I think there is a level of backing up important things. Because I think one of the things we do end up with is we end up with this backup fatigue. And if you offer to people, you must back up everything, you must do this. Well, actually, on a WordPress site, there's very little you actually really, really, really have to back up. We have to back up the database because that's where data is. We probably want to back up our WP Contents uploads folder because that's where the files are that we've uploaded. Do we need to back up the WordPress core files? No. We can get those quickly unless we've been making some weird modifications. We can get those very quickly. Do I need to get back up most of the plugins? No. Those plugins I can get from the WordPress repo or from other places. Do I need to back up my custom plugins? Probably, but have I got those in version control somewhere else? Can these things be recreated really quickly? And all of a sudden, we're looking around and going, actually, what we need to back up is quite minimum. That's great, because now we can back it up lots more. So anybody who was going, I can't do backups because I can't do daily backup because it takes up too much space. Maybe consider, what are you backing up and do we need to? And it's the same with your computer at home. So many people back up their entire using Windows C drive. And it's like, okay, why did you do that? That's a lot of stuff, including temporary files you didn't need to do. There are times where you do want to back up stuff like that, but it's rare. And for the average person, just like for the average site owner, you can probably minimize your backups to just what you might need and recreate everything else quickly. But that relies on you being able to recreate it quickly, which really only works if you've got a decent automated deployment system or automation in place. or you're using a managed host. But somewhere where, in the perfect world, you should be able to just run a script and go, ta-da, my site is back. And if you're not there yet, that's maybe, as we're coming into 2024, if this might come out after 2024, that the goal should be for your 2024 should be, you could go to spin up your website and go, okay, I need to get my site up and running now. And you should be able to go, da-da, and that would be it. The site is loaded because your script is running in automated. If you can't do that at the moment, your site's probably not in a good enough place and it needs to get better, because there will be reasons that you will have to do this in the next couple of years, because everybody will have problems at some point.
Yep, so true. So we talked about backups. We've talked about patching. I really want to dive into user roles for a minute. And that's really important to this whole scenario. So what happens in the WordPress world, and coming from an enterprise background, both of us, it's a little different. You go into a bank and they say, this teller needs access. You only give the teller what they need access to. In the WordPress world, every site owner stomps their feet and says, I own the website. I want everybody to have admin rights. And I look at them and say, then I'm not working with you. Because that's my standard answer. And I'll tell the story. Recently, I had a client who insisted had his intern get admin rights. And I had a long discussion with him and said, you're not doing this. He said, it's my site. I said, so sign me a letter that says, if your intern screws up, I can bill you 5 hours at my regular rate on a 5-hour minimum, regardless of what he does. Okay. How long do you think it took the intern to screw the website up? 2 days.
Well, of course, he got a really good telling that this shouldn't happen, and he was so ultra careful. So I'd give it 20 minutes.
Yeah, so not only did he intern do that, you're going to love this, Tim. He read an article that's saying backup plugins and security plugins cause website bloat and slow websites down. So he deleted the backup plugin. He deleted the security plugin. On an e-commerce site that had transactions. I know. So the lesson here is, don't let your site owners, despite the fact that they own these websites, all have admin rights. Most site owners don't need admin rights. What they need is somebody to manage it for them that they trust. Your thoughts?
I mean, some admin owners probably do really well with admin rights. I have in the past created super duper admin role, which is a author role, which could also see other posts. So they can see that their people are being busy bees, but they can't do anything. And then I give the super duper admin role to the boss. And whoever that works quite well. Generally, what I recommend when you're coming to auditing a site and you see a list of humongous list of admins is you go, what we're going to do is we're going to put everybody down to editor. And we'll then wait to see who comes and complains. If someone can't come and complain within the first week, they probably didn't need to be an admin. That gives us enough time. When someone comes along, they say, I need to do this. You can go, okay. The thing is, most people don't realize that WordPress actually has quite a good capability system behind the scenes. So a role is just a collection of capabilities, and the capabilities is just an if statement. So when you go to do a task, if the task is being checked against, it'll be checked against a capability, which let's say a user can read post.
Yeah,
pretty much everybody can, but a user can read post. So we'll go. So basically, it goes in and it goes to your user into your user meta and finds this big array of things that you can do. And it looks for that string inside there. And if you matches, says yes. So you can add capabilities to any user. I wouldn't recommend doing that. You can just say, okay, I want to make this person able to manage users. So you can just give them the capability. You can go into the database and edit it. You can use something like WP CLI, you can use a plugin. I wouldn't do that specifically because that becomes an administrative nightmare trying to work out who has what capabilities. This is why we have roles, but you can create a super editor role or a very specific role. That's why the WooCommerce has its shop manager roles, for example.
Yes.
You give them the capabilities they want. This works really well. So if you've got the designer person and they must have access to the appearances section, sure, create a designer role. If Joe's secretary must add users, give them the get option to create users. That one's a bit more iffy because you have to do some hacking to make sure that they can't totally abuse that. But you can give them the ability to create users, and then you can just make sure that they can't create admin users. Yeah. You can give these people specific roles with specific capabilities rather than just blank admin and super admin roles. But yeah, the boss, give him the shiny role. The other really cruel way to do this is to give the boss the administrator role and then just remove all the capabilities you don't want them to have.
I've done that before.
And then you, and then give yourself the web agency role with all of them back in.
Yeah. That's a really good conversation. Now, we know there's third-party products out there. PatchStack, Securi, a couple others, which I won't mention for a number of reasons. What do you think about using something like PatchStack on your front end to help you? I think there's some value in that. What do you think?
So I'm never going to tell someone not to use a security plugin, because that way madness lies and lots of arguments with people on hills. I think security plugins have their place, and they're oddly in the places that most people don't realize. Where I don't think they're very good is using them as web application firewalls on the whole. Because that's what a host is there for. There are some times that they have unique advantages because they can hook inside your system and know that you've got certain plugins set up in certain ways that would allow for certain thing to happen, and they can block that certain thing from happening at that level that your host wouldn't normally be able to see and get that sort of insight into. But on the whole, their WAFs are fairly useless and are just taking up processing power that didn't need to happen. When it comes to vulnerability management and telling you that you've got a vulnerable plugin, there's some real value in that. Now, if we're not on an automatic updating world, we need to know that there are vulnerable plugins. So that vulnerability scanning and vulnerability management kind of, I think, is key. And if you can find a good tool that you get on with, you should have some sort of vulnerability management. Again, this is one of those cautionary tales of not relying on your host. Most managed WordPress hosts have vulnerability management now. If you go into WP Engine, it will have its plugins page and it will show you, hey, this plugin's out of date and insecure. But they're getting that information through these companies remotely third-partied sometimes. They're either slow and taking too long to get that information, or worse, they try to be proactive. And there's nothing worse than a managed host trying to be proactive about things, because they inevitably cock it up and things go wrong. And we saw that recently. There was a bunch of plugins that were getting positively flagged as having as being vulnerable. And the post status chat had like this stream of developers coming in and going, "Is anybody here work for insert hosting company? Is anybody here work for this hosting company?" So there is value for the vulnerability scanning. There is value in some of the features. But bunging all these features together into one plugin and saying, this is the security plugin that will fix your world, rarely is, because they're not, normally they require setup. They require understanding of what they're doing. They require you to do other things, but they sell themselves as, this is the future, this you do, install me and you will be fine. I like PatchStack. I like the people at PatchStack.
I do too.
But if you go to their homepage, I do not believe if the average person could tell you what PatchStack does.
No,
I'm not sure the average security person could tell you what PatchStack does. What they could say tell you is that they've got a marketing person who's really good at making up very long words.
He is right.
So PatchStack's got the PatchStack. So you end up in this scenario, but it's not just PatchStack. Every security plugin is the same. It's full of lots of words, full of lots of promises, some of which can come true if you correctly configure them and do things in certain ways. But for a lot of people, if you're on a managed host, for example, they should be taking care of most of this stuff. And the real irony, if you're on a really dirt cheap host, they're probably taking care of this because the stack them high and sell them low, really, really cheap hosts have really locked down WAFs to because they do not, because they know if they get an infection on one site, they get it across the board. And they're basically selling themselves on, they're just stamping out WordPress sites that are configured in a certain way and fixed in a certain way, and only you can't deviate from it. So they are in a relatively good place. The managed WordPress host people are in it, and these security plugins tend to fit in the middle area. Those people who are on the shared hosts or on VPSs that they perhaps shouldn't be managing themselves. I wouldn't, for example, use the two-factor authentication from my security plugin. I'd get a dedicated plugin to do that. I wouldn't use the auditing and logging tools for it. I'm not even sure I'd use the malware scanning. I'd much rather see the malware scanning being done by an external thing.
I should point out every major
security plugin has had at least one time where there's been a vulnerability, and the first thing they do is turn off the security plugin. Particularly WordFence are affected because they're just sheer popularity. It's becoming increasingly common to see bad actors come in and disable WordFence's rules. So they can scan all they like. It's not going to do anything because it's just been turned off.
And let's jump in there with malware scanners. I was going to go there. So Dan Nouse, who's up at Stellar, and I had a conversation, which we recorded for this show some time ago, out of a conversation he had on the Stellar site that said there is no point in running malware scanners with inside your website. And I so heartily agree with that philosophy because of exactly what you're saying. And even more so is you're always better running a scanner outside the environment that you're scanning it. And we know that. And I'll share with you the dirty little secret security guy. I do not run a Windows virus checker on my PC at all. Now, people say you're foolish. No, I know what to do. I know what to look for. I know that if I'm doing something complicated and I fire up a virtual machine and do it there and I'm going to delete the machine, I don't play that game. I do my scanning, even in Windows, outside the environment I'm in. And I don't think scanning inside the environment is a good idea.
I mean, I don't, but I would also argue that if you're in a scenario where you don't have the opportunity to have an external scanning tool, that you're not in the position because you're, for whatever reason, your hosting is set up that way, it's still better than nothing.
But I agree.
If you're in a scenario where this is already happening, then it's not like it's better for you to do it twice. It's not going to pick up anything that the other tooling won't. So they do have different rule sets. So there is a potential that they could pick up something different, but it's unlikely. They're probably coming from a relatively common source base. But it's still, I wouldn't immediately jump to you should never do this, because there is a scenario where you're at in the middle of these two scales that we were talking about. That area, it's better than nothing. And that's again why I'm like, one interesting thing that from when I was doing hosting was that you were just as likely to be hacked with a security plugin installed than if you weren't.
That's interesting. And let's talk about
exactly the percentage statistics was exactly the difference was the type of attacks. And the type of thing. So they did stop some things, but then they just didn't stop others.
And let's talk about hosting. So I'm a believer that your hosting has to be a partner in your website, not a vendor, number one. So if my host treats me like a client, I'm gone. The other thing is we got to be really careful with shared hosting. And a lot of people, for economic reasons, go to a shared host. The problem with that is if site number one, and then they'll say, oh, let me load 10 hosts up on my same control panel, on my same cPanel. That is not a good idea, because all you got to do is hack one site, and we know on a shared host, unless it's containerized, and there are some shared hosts that do that, once you hack one site, it just goes cross cPanel and goes cross host. And that's how you end up in these scenarios where you have 100, 200 sites hacked very quickly. I don't believe, from my standpoint, shared hosting is a good idea. I actually, I'm almost at the point of view where VPS hosting is not necessarily a good idea, because I call VPS just a glorified shared host, just in a different way. Thoughts?
So I think it's worth clarifying what a shared host is, because actually you jumped in and said containerized as shared. So shared hosting, in the traditional sense, when we talk about shared hosting, we're talking about either a dedicated box, but actually it's more likely these days a VPS, which has either Apache or Nginx or something sitting on it that then has a bunch of websites, and they all share all the resources, all the memory, and they're something we refer to as jailed. Sometimes we call them C groups, but we basically prevent individual sites' SFTP users being able to come back up the chain to see each other. But you're all sharing everything. Which means, and this is literally the best example, is this is a shared house. You come into through the front door, you all come through the same front door, you just go off to your individual rooms. Now, if the police come to raid you because somebody was making vodka and vodka jellies in the bathtub, well, you're going to find that you're hauled outside too. And that, so when, and to put that back into a perspective of a website, let's say Joe goes and blasts an email spam list and starts spamming out Viagra websites. The IP of the server that you are on is now going to be blocked on the block lists of all major email providers. You can't send email. It's the equivalent of, you know, finding the guy making the vodka jelly in your bathtub. Our next setup sort of from there is, okay, well, we probably shouldn't be doing business from our house. We've decided this. We don't want people coming and knocking on our house. We're going to go and set up a concession stand in the mall. So we're going to the shopping mall. We're going to set up our little concession stand. That's a VPS. We don't own the hardware, but we have our own little resources, our own little space in the mall, and we can go and do shopping. On the whole, this comes with lots of advantages. The mall security guard walks around for us. We don't get rained on, and there isn't a guy. If the guy is selling vodka jellies in the other stand, it doesn't affect us. But if our if the mall gets shut down for any reason, i.e. the server our VPS is on, well, we get shut down too. Now, it's worth saying at this point that the mall analogy works for containers and containerization. Now, if you're ever being told of the word cloud hosting, what you're really being sold is a bunch of containers. There's some stuff behind the scenes, but it's a bunch of containers. And a bunch of containers, most VPS hosting, when it's sold to you, probably is in fact containerized hosting and not VPSs. A virtual private VPS is, normally we would consider something a VPS if it had its own kernel. Now that's getting deep down into the roots, but basically it has its own version of Windows or its own version of macOS or its own Linux system inside the box. With containerization, you have everything yourself except that very bottom layer, which is the kernel, which is served by the thing below that. Now, containerization and VPS sit at the same levels. On the whole, we can cross between the two and not worry about it. There are some times where we need to sort of like separate them out. But on the whole, we can call cloud hosting, VPS, containerization, same sort of thing, all on that level. And then at the top, well, we own the house. We own the building. And all the problems that go with that. Brilliant thing about dedicated hosting is that you are completely in charge of everything to do with it, because you have a physical piece of bare metal. We sometimes call it bare. You can get bare metal cloud, but that's a whole other thing. We call it bare metal because it's literally you get the motherboard, the hard drives and everything, and they're plugged in. Now, whether that's co-location or whether you're renting a box, that dedicated hosting is probably ideal for a lot of people, except for the fact it's really expensive, really hard to maintain, and hardware dies. And when it dies, you don't have a website until you put it on another piece of hardware.
And it dies.
And then that dies. Now, you can get really clever and you can go, okay, I'm going to put this piece of hardware here, this piece of hardware here, and I'm going to load balance, and then I won't have this problem. Yeah. And now you're a hosting company and you just didn't know it. Once we scale like that. All of this is to say, I actually think the underlying technology, whether it's shared, VPS, cloud, dedicated, is less of a thing than the service being provided on top of it for you. I do not like shared hosting. Shared hosting is bad. There are almost no scenarios I could think where I'd recommend someone use shared hosting, especially as VPS and containerized hosting is so cheap in comparison. But I do think that you should look more at what management services are being offered to you by the host and their support and how everything works with the host, then worry about what that underlying technology is, unless you are a techie. I would much rather see people going on a managed WordPress host and not knowing whether they're on a dedicated or a VPS or cloud hosting, but going on decent managed hosting, than I would them sitting on a thing with cPanel that's just been configured once and forgotten about. Which is the vast majority of cheap hosting. And you can get really shitty shared hosting, and you can get equally as shitty dedicated hosting. The difference is that one charged you $5 a month and the other one charged you $5,000 a month. And that is the sort of scale difference we can be sometimes looking at. Not always. You can get a dedicated metal box from somebody like OVH or Hertzner for like $30, but it comes with zero support and you're on your own. You can get managed WordPress hosting for like $9, $10 that's on shared, that's not on shared hosting, that's on a VPS. So you should probably invest that. The other thing I would say is that if you're a business, and you can think back to when we had these things called stores, bricks and mortar places you would walk into, and you think about how much that costs to rent. And then you think about your hosting and you're complaining because you have to pay $10, not $5. It shouldn't be that cost line shouldn't, you should just be absorbing it, not moaning about it. I'd like people to pay more for their hosting. Generally, I think people underpay their hosting because they want to get a cheaper deal. And I think that they would have easier lives if they spent a little bit more and got decent hosting. The problem is finding that decent host in the first place, because they're very hard to find.
I agree. And one of the things you touched on, you were talking about IP issues if the server gets blocked. And it's one of the biggest reasons I say to clients, find an email provider to put your email on. Don't ever put it on your host. So we know there's workspaces if you choose to go that route. I don't. There's Office 365 if you choose to go that route. I don't. There's companies like Pronto Mail, which now offers secured email. I don't. I actually use a company that's privacy-based called Fastmail out of Australia. They're wonderful, I will say that, and they don't pay me for that plug. So their app is really good. And that way, if I have an email issue, I'm not dealing with a host and saying, hey guys, your IP range has got blocked. I'm dealing with an email company. So I think people need to stop cheaping out on email as well.
Yeah, going back to, I worked for a hosting company. We jokingly would say that people don't actually pay for websites. They pay for email hosting with free websites.
Yep.
Because if email went down, the phones lit up.
We could take
whole segments of our network down for the web hosting, and we'd get an uptick. Don't get me wrong, people would still complain and they'd still be upset. But you take someone's email away from them for even a few minutes and whoa, the phones just go.
My 79-year-old mother had a problem 4 weeks ago where she was paying an email provider, and she came to me and said, Rob, I haven't gotten any email in 14 hours. What's wrong here? So I picked up the phone. I did, you know, knowing the way support goes, and called support. It turned out her problem was her mailbox was full. So she's undiplomatically a pack rat, and doesn't clean up her email box. So I, in the interim, I just said, forget this. Let's just take the box to a terabyte box because the cost difference wasn't worth it. And said, just do it and do it now. Problem solved. But it's exactly what you're saying. Email goes down and people scream. When I was in enterprise, I was also an exchange admin. So I've been on that side of it. And when and we had 9 exchange servers all synced. And when one went down, you would watch the numbers in the call center go to 200 calls waiting over in 5 minutes. Email is the brunt of our existence, no question.
Yeah. And it's like anything, you get what you pay for. If you're getting, you're using the free email that comes with your hosting, sometimes it can be remarkably good. I don't want to decry it, but on the whole, I would say if you want to get that support, you need to go to a third party. There were plenty of options out there. For me, like you, data privacy, data sovereignty is important to me. I would say that if you've got if you're interested in data privacy and data sovereignty, there are lots of options out there. These tend to come at a cost because the big hosting companies effectively act like the mafia. They hustle and each other. They will only accept each other's mail. Even somebody like if you want to send stuff to Hotmail or Outlook, you really are going to have to think about looking at the larger companies or be in a constant fight to get these to work. And that's really frustrating and it's wrong. And we shouldn't be in this scenario, but we currently are. So for most people, I do tend to push them towards the bigger companies for their make their lives easier, while simultaneously hating myself and the fact that this is the world we live in. I would put a shout out for Proton Mail. I do think that that's a good service. Fastmail, you mentioned Fastmail as well. Both are privacy focused, but the vast majority of customers will go to Google Workspaces, Google G Suite, whatever it's called this week, and Office 365 they are the places where that's going to be guaranteed and reliable. And that's so frustrating that that's the recommendation that you have to give at times because it shouldn't be that way.
Yeah, Fastmail is actually really reasonable. They're like $5 US a month per hosting account. Unlimited aliases for each account. So if you want to go that route, and they get, and believe it or not, they're so confident in their product, they give you the first 30 days for free, no questions.
Which is nice.
Yeah, the
it's
only
always nice when you get free, but free to try it out for a decent period of time.
Yeah.
The other thing is that migrating email is actually a complete utter pig. So look for something that you like. Because you're going to end up sticking with it. It's not like hosting, which you can swap hosts pretty quickly. Swapping your email is a bit more of a nightmare at times. So it's worth taking that time to see if you actually like the hosting. It provides the support and the services that you want. Don't feel you have to migrate over straight away. The other thing is that maybe consider that you set up a dedicated mydomain.email. And only use that for hosting, because a lot of the blacklists and blocklists that use IP reputation. So, for example, let's say I have my website hosted at DigitalOcean.
Yeah,
that's great. Unfortunately, that means that I can't send email from my main email provider to most things like Gmail and similar, because I'm on their entire IP range is put on several blocklists. Yeah. Now, in that scenario, you could send, if I had timnash.email, I could send the email through that way using that address because that's not associated with my main website.
Yep.
So that's something else to consider. And this also means that you can use this for testing as well, so that you could maybe set up get a really cheap domain name and then set up some tests on various email providers, find the one you like, then migrate your main platform across.
Yeah.
But yeah, hopefully you don't all move to Google because that would be sad.
It would be. The other thing worth mentioning is, just because we're talking email and talking IP blocking, is if you're going to cold email potential clients, do not, and I stress, do not do it off your main email account. Create a domain similar so that if it gets blocked, your main email account does get blocked, and that would be a shame. So don't do that, please.
Yeah, I cannot overstate that. That's to be honest, I really do not recommend not having your email associated to your main account at all. But also, if you're using your web host to send email through, maybe consider using a third party tool like SES or SendGrid or similar. They'll have a higher reliability rate because they're not coming through your own servers. But also, this gives you a nice separation so that if your site gets hacked, your server that's being hacked is not inside that SPF record and therefore isn't immediately being authenticated as, yes, go ahead and send and we approve this message. You'd much rather be in a position where you're not sending that. The other thing with using a third party service is they tend to have quotas and limits and let you know that you're, did you mean to send 10,000 emails out just then? And you can go, no, I really didn't. Please stop doing that. And you can shut them down a lot more easily. So I generally, email's a pain though. We should just stop using email.
I wish. So this conversation has been great. So to kind of wrap up, give your quick three condensed takeaways that somebody should do when locking down their WordPress site real quickly.
Go away and remove all the users, throw them away, turn off everything, delete the WP admin area entirely, which by the way is something you can do, and your site will work quite happily without any user interaction there. Seriously, keep things up to date. Yeah. That's the takeaway I want anybody to take from this. All the other stuff we've talked about is great. Keep your site up to date. As you said earlier, the time between a vulnerability being exposed and it being actually used and abused on your site is getting smaller. We used to talk about this in terms of weeks. And then last year, we were talking about it in days. This year, we've been talking about it in hours. Also, just because someone has exploited it doesn't mean you're going to know about it for weeks or even months. So that's getting longer. So this means it is really critical to keep the site up to date, to consider this. You have this point where you regularly review users. It can be 6 months. I'd rather it be less. But let's say every 6 months we do a review. We go through all our users. Hey, that admin user, we sacked him, right? Why is he still there? Oh, who's that? Why is that WooCommerce user suddenly an admin user? That doesn't seem right. We should probably deal with that. Go through your users. Use MFA, even though we've talked a little bit about how it can be bypassed. Use secure passwords. Educate your users. And I think the combination, so keep things up to date, use MFA and secure passwords as one. And educate your users would be my three takeaways. Keep things up to date.
If somebody wants to get a hold of you, Tim, the employer services, talk security, how's the best way?
Best way to get hold of me is to visit my website, timnash.co.uk, and you can book a 20-minute chat with me. We can talk about anything. It's not like I'm going to shove a sales pitch on you. Come to me with your questions, quite happy to answer them. But I do, my day-to-day job is that I primarily do site reviews. So I do secure code and secure site reviews where I go along and go through your site and find all the problems and then help you fix them. So I basically produce this nice report. We'll go through it. We've got a bunch of recommendations. And that makes me different from your normal pen tester because I have the advantage that I've lived in your shoes. So I know what it's like and I can give you an actual recommendation rather than just telling you something benign, like, oh, you should definitely hide your WordPress login page.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't have things showing that you're using WordPress and stuff like that, that your average pen test will come back and there's a load of waffle. But yeah, come talk to me. I'm quite happy answering questions. I don't really do social media anymore. I was off Twitter before. It was cool to be off Twitter. But you can also find me on LinkedIn. My LinkedIn handle's at tnash.
Tim, this conversation's been absolutely awesome. Thanks for being so gracious with your time. Have a great day.
You too. It was great to chat to you.
This show is brought to you by stunningdigitalmarketing.com, your Toronto leader in digital marketing services. Not only do we protect your WordPress website, we can help you with your site, provide social media management for your business, or even do one-on-one consulting. To find out more, go to stunningdigitalmarketing.com. A very special thank you to Tim Nash for joining me on this edition of the SDM Show. Hey, everybody, Rob here again. Thanks for listening to the SDM Show. It's such a pleasure to have you every week. If you want more on our agency website, go to stunningdigitalmarketing.com. We are your WordPress security experts. We'd be glad to help you out. If you want to learn more about me, Rob Cairns, go to meetrobcairns.online. From there, you can find links to everything I do on the web, as well as book time with me. So feel free. If you want to make comments about this podcast or know a guest possibly suitable for the podcast, please email us at podcast@stunningdigitalmarketing.com. Or conversely, you can go to X, formerly known as Twitter, and tweet at me at Rob Cairns. This podcast is dedicated to my late father, Bruce Cairns. Dad, I miss you very much and I love you. Please join us next week for another interesting podcast and have a great week, everybody. Bye for now.